This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. This is Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. It's time for Law and Behold. And today, continuing with our series, we are looking at the recent arrests of undocumented migrants across Kuala Lumpur and the move to turn away hundreds of Rohingya refugees stranded at sea by the authorities. So all of this raised concerns among many. And today we want to discuss, you know, the rights of boat people, you know, the mass arrests that have been happening and the following xenophobia that has transpired online and in Malaysia, and how the law should be protected vulnerable members of the community in a time of crisis. And joining me to do this are Firdaus Husni, the Chief Human Rights Strategist at the Malaysian Centre for Constitutionalism and Human Rights, and constitutional lawyer Surendra Anand. Welcome, guys. How are you today?
Good. Thank you. Hello.
Hello, it's nice to hear both of you again. So, you know, as I mentioned, several large-scale joint operations were carried out to catch undocumented migrants. You know, this was, of course, as part of the government's efforts to contain the spread of COVID-19. But, you know, according to rights groups, those detained included young children and even, you know, ethnic Rohingya refugees from Myanmar. And, you know, these rights groups, they also pointed out, for example, that many of those arrested are asylum seekers and not formally registered by the United Nations Refugee Agency, UNHCR. So, you know, this kind of puts them in a precarious situation because they're simply categorized as undocumented migrants. So what are your thoughts on, you know, all these arrests that have been happening and, you know, whether this is a violation of human rights?
There's a few angles that we can talk about when we look at the mass arrests by the government. One, from the point of effectively addressing the pandemic, the COVID-19 pandemic, I don't see how any of the action, how any of the arrest is helping to address that, because due to the nature of COVID-19 itself, it is important to ensure that everyone, not just Malaysians, non-Malaysians, have the right to healthcare. So, you know, that is one of the biggest concerns that civil societies have also raised. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what has been happening, it's not that only what this month or this year that we see or rather that we have undocumented migrants in Malaysia. And for some reason, this time around, you can sense that there's a rise in xenophobia. Mm. If you look at social media, and that's very concerning. It's not just discrimination or stereotyping. There are even calls to end the lives of these undocumented migrants, and that's something that's very worrying and very scary to note indeed.
Yeah, just to quickly add on, I'm sure that we will go into international law at some point later in the show, but just looking at it from a domestic human rights perspective, a lot of people forgot that, or tend to forget that, the right to life and the right to equal treatment are guaranteed under the Constitution. And most importantly, it's guaranteed to all persons. Mm. While some other rights, like free speech, is given only to citizens. So the right to life, the right to equality is given to all.
Surin, I've lost you. Surin?
Hello.
Hi, Firdaus. I can hear you, but I've lost Surin.
Oh, hello. Okay.
Ah, Surin, okay. Now you're back.
Ah. Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can. Okay, so I think I lost you at the point where you said freedom of speech is afforded to citizens and not to all persons.
Yeah, should I just continue from there?
Yes, can.
Yeah, so right to life and the right to equal treatment are afforded to all persons, and the Constitution does not distinguish as to the status of that person. So while you might be undocumented, regardless of your status, you're still entitled to the right to life, which includes the right to humane treatment and also to dignity of life. So I think that's an aspect which we need to remember, that our Constitution actually guarantees these certain rights, regardless of your status in the country. And that's not even going to international law yet, of course.
Mm, but, you know, our Defence Minister, Dato' Sri Ismail Sabri, he said that Malaysia is just following the laws of this country, you know, that even though the migrants were living under lockdown, their presence is still illegal. And therefore, you know, I remember yesterday in his press briefing, he said that you know, all countries across the world, they are doing this, you know, that is their right to clamp down on undocumented and illegal migrants in Malaysia.
That has been, to me, that has been their fallback argument every time a questions or you know, a backlash was raised as to the treatment of undocumented migrants in the country. And to me, that does not take into account that even our own constitution, just like what Suren said earlier, make a mention in certain provisions like the right to life, like the right to equality and equal protection of the law, it does not say only citizens. It says no persons shall be denied their right to life, and all persons are entitled to equal protection. So I do not think that statement by the minister takes into account that there's a reason why these particular provisions are as such while other provisions are not.
That's right. And, you know, it goes against everything that he announced back on the 22nd of March, you know, when the government said that they agreed to neither look into the legal status of foreigners nor take any action against them for being in the country illegally, you know, when they came forward for COVID-19 screenings. Am I correct?
Yes. When that assurance was first given, it was clear and it was transparent. I think we can all agree that was premised on the concern to effectively address and contain COVID-19. And so exactly on that concern and premise, there shouldn't be a U-turn in the approach by the government. But that is what we are seeing today. And I don't know which goes first, whether it was propelled by these xenophobic sentiments on social media or the other way around. But either way, it's definitely, you know, a change or a reversal in the approach, which was correct the first time around.
That's right. I mean, because, you know, when you resort to these sort of mass arrests, you know, that will invariably create a culture of fear that will just ripple out amongst the migrant communities and, I guess, you know, completely scare them away from coming forward to be tested at all if, you know, they manage to escape being arrested.
Yeah. And even if you look at this from a pure nationalist point of view, I just don't see how it benefits anyone. If you're only looking at addressing the COVID-19 pandemic, then detaining people and putting them in detention centers, that's quite the opposite than to address the COVID-19 scenario. So whichever angle they look at this, I just don't see how one can justify the most recent actions by the government.
So, you know, for those who have been arrested or detained, you know, do they have legal rights here in Malaysia if you know, they are being placed in detention centres?
So there are laws, domestic laws, which addresses how they should be treated. You know, these are largely under the Immigration Act, that's one. And if they are, for example, a victim of trafficking or smuggling, we have the Anti-Trafficking in Persons and Anti-Smuggling of Migrants Act, and a couple of other domestic acts, depending on the situations they are in. For example, if they have been exploited by their employers, then there is the Employment Act. There's the Workmen's Compensation Act. The trouble here is that the government a couple of years ago set up what is called the National Legal Aid Foundation, but this legal aid does not extend to non-Malaysian. And so they are cut off from, you know, from accessing that as, you know, as an avenue to help them to access this legal recourse.
Because, you know, like you said, like, even though the avenues for legal redress are available, I mean, what would the sort of indigent state of the many migrants, you know, it's quite likely to place them, you know, in a situation where they can't actually seek legal action, right?
Yes, that's right. Because the way that they are treated in the country, that in itself, it's not does not provide a conducive environment for them to seek justice in a situation where they are where they are, you know, in a predicament not by their own volition. For example, they paid a lot of money thinking that they will be here on, you know, on a legitimate visa. They'll be given legitimate work, only to find out that when they're here, there's no such thing as a legitimate visa, no work at all, and you know, they've been left with nothing. And they have nothing to, you know, to that they can, you know, that can help them to go back. So in that situation, where would they go? And if they were to go to the authorities, it's going to be them who's facing the system, not the person who put them in that predicament in the first place. So that is definitely something that, you know, that should be improved within our system and within how we treat them.
So are there any sort of action-oriented policies, practices or strategies that are in place to sort of prevent human rights violations and abuses against non-documented migrants here in Malaysia?
I think in Malaysia, I mean, Firdaus can correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems to be more of a knee-jerk reaction sort of scenario here. We don't have any comprehensive plan on how to address this situation on asylum seekers and refugees. So an example of a knee-jerk reaction was that I think the AG's chambers, the Attorney General chambers, did come up with a policy not to charge persons who have UNHCR cards for being here illegally, for example. But besides that, I can't really think of any concrete policies. And the only reason typically given by the government is that they are not a signatory to the Refugee Convention. But I think many forget that the Refugee Convention is not the only convention that governs how a country should be treating asylum seekers and refugees. That convention was drafted way back in 1951, where there was no human rights conventions in place at that time. But since 1951, you had a whole number of human rights conventions, which include the Convention Against Discrimination Against Women, the Convention on the Rights of Children, and the Convention on the Rights of Disabled Persons, all of which Malaysia has signed and ratified, which includes, through its jurisprudence, the obligation of non-refoulement, which is obligation not to send persons back to a place where they can be tortured, and also the obligation to treat these categories of persons humanely and provide them with certain fundamental rights. So just because Malaysia is not a signatory to the Refugee Convention, that does not mean they are not obligated under international law to come up with a proper framework to address the scenario on asylum seekers and refugees. That obligation is still there under international law. So something needs to be done, and it has to be comprehensive. Or else, you know, like Firdaus said, they're going to be left in this continuous scenario where they will always be oppressed, afraid, in this very non-conducive environment. And until that is addressed, I don't think anyone is going to benefit, neither the state, nor the refugees or asylum seekers.
Firdaus, is there anything you wanted to add to that?
Yes. So when talking about, you know, reforms and the way forward, what the MCCHR has done is to this. Well, this took place last year. We actually got a couple of NGOs working on this issue together to look into ATIPSOM, the Anti-Trafficking and Anti-Smuggling Act, and what we were discussing is that there is a recognition that when you look in the contents of ATIPSOM, it does not recognize modern slavery. So as we talk about federal constitution earlier, Suren mentioned right to life, right to equality, but there is also in Article 6 that no person shall be held to slavery. You know, we may think that this is of, you know, of no relevance, but when you talk about exploitation and discrimination against migrant workers, including the undocumented migrant, these are, you know, real life scenarios that they are facing, and there are certain aspects of the law which do not entirely or effectively address this. So those are one of the proposal that we include in that through that consultation process. We also want to expand the factors in which one can be persecuted under Tipsom and, you know, for modern slavery. And this could include, you know, coercion, deception, fraud, abuse of vulnerabilities. So these are, you know, the factors that court should also look into, and not just, are you coerced into it? But what if that person willingly, you know, pay up an agent, not coerced, but thinking that it was all legitimate, only to find out much, much later that it's not? Is that covered under the law? So that those were the issues we're looking at. Also, when we talk about, corporations, this is not, you know, this is not in our present system. What about corporations or companies? It should be within their business and human rights structure to make sure that in the supply chain, there is no usage of victims of trafficking or smuggling. So these are among the issues that we want to look at. What happened if employer withhold migrants' passport? What do they do? And as you mentioned earlier also, the legal remedies that are available. So these are all what we included in a recommendation. And, giving credit where credit is due, when we approach MAPO, the Anti-Trafficking Council, National Council, they are responsive, and we actually presented these recommendations to them.
Yeah, because we've seen, the kind of horrors that come from human trafficking. I mean, just looking at what happened, the death camp in Wang Kalian, for example, that gave us a clear picture of, terrible human rights violations. And it seems that, especially in this situation where the world is in a lockdown and everything is so, we're not sure what's happening. Gathering all these migrant workers, these undocumented migrants, and putting them in a camp, that just makes them even more susceptible to, human trafficking, to, all sorts of abuses.
Yes, definitely. I would have thought that when we, first discovered that death camp, it was a shock, to the country, and it was, it was a lesson to learn as to what do we do now about the agents or about the traffickers. But, our attention should be on them, or our dislikes should be on these people who exploited the undocumented migrants in the first place. Or rather who exploited these people who then, because of them, turned into undocumented migrants. But we after a while, you hear there's a Royal Commission of Inquiry, not long after that discovery. That's and then right. After that, we barely hear anything about the RCI, about what action is taken upon that discovery. So that's a very sad, I want to say, we mudah lupa, but we shouldn't. And then you hear what we did with the people fleeing on boats, forgetting that everyone has the right to asylum when they are fleeing from persecution in their own country. Mm-hmm. Everyone has a right to health, and that should include access to healthcare, right to work and be paid, and a whole host of other rights under the international conventions.
Yeah, and I think, this pandemic is really demonstrating the danger of gaps, that undocumented migrant workers and refugees have, especially with, limited access to health or social welfare services. And, but all of that then sort of transfers to the wider population as well, doesn't it?
Yes. Before COVID-19 and before, this rising xenophobia, I would describe it as polarizing. On the one hand, we have the political parties in our country, calling out for justice, pushing for aids to the Rohingya community, and highlighting their plight. On the other hand, at the same time, in the country, when we talk about their right to work, their right to education, their right to health, these are something that their rights that have been violated long before. And I'll give one quick example. If they were to fall sick, and they were to go to a hospital, the one major thing that holds them back is the fear that they will be reported to the authorities if they were to go to the hospital and seek treatment. Mm-hmm. So there is already that fear. And you know, when the government imposed this mass arrest, it only aggravated that fear and clearly will not help address the COVID-19 pandemic.
That's right. Because by law, I think healthcare workers, they have to report any undocumented migrants who come and seek healthcare. Is that correct? Am I correct?
That's what I'm hearing too.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Okay. All right. So, you know, just looking at what we're seeing online as well, you know, I'm just talking about xenophobia. You know, there's just been a surge, I suppose, in vitriol and hatred towards migrant workers. You know, a lot of the comments that have been coming out, you know, it's negative and prejudiced comments about, you know, many of them saying that the Rohingya are not a problem, they should go home. You know, many of them are accusing them of spreading the coronavirus, you know, being a burden on state resources. I mean, what are your thoughts on that? And, you know, do you think we should have some laws in place to prevent such hate speech from happening online? Or do we already have it, but, you know, because it's against migrant workers, undocumented some more, nothing is really happening in that sense?
Yeah, I think this is quite unfortunate. And I think a lot of this is premised on a lot of misconceptions. If I can just correct a few, the first is, well, the Rohingya came here voluntarily and they had a choice. That's a big misconception because they were forced to come here due to atrocities committed back in Myanmar. And while you can read a lot of reports that might say otherwise, I would suggest to people to go online and read the judgments of the International Criminal Court and the Court of Justice. Both are international courts where preliminary judgments have quite clearly shown the kind of atrocities that they have gone through where they are forced to leave. Now, the second misconception is that why do they have to come here? We not have another settlement in Bangladesh called Bashanchar. That settlement is not even open. And in fact, Bangladesh announced late February that they're not going to open the settlement because the UNHCR did not endorse it. So they have no other option. So I think those are the two big misconceptions we have that needs to be rid of. Now, the second thing on this sudden surge of xenophobic comments that is unfortunate is that I think sometime last year, PAS and UMNO had a convention or conference of sorts, a public rally to support Rohingya. And a lot of people were expressing support for them. Now, the very same people have just suddenly changed their mind and are taking the complete opposite position without any basis whatsoever. So I think that just doesn't seem right and just seems a bit too convenient in terms of the timing. Now, number three, a lot of people are saying, well, I've had some experiences with migrant workers, Rohingya, and they are not people that you want to be with, etc. Again, I think this sort of comments just doesn't make any sense because you cannot blame an entire race, an entire group of people based on your personal experience with some individuals. That to me is just outright racism. And lastly, on the hate speech point, well, unfortunately, we have a lot of widely worded laws that can easily cover hate speech. I think Firdaus would agree that those laws are quite clearly unconstitutional. We have some laws in the Communications Act and Penal Code. We don't have a specific hate speech law, which I think we should enact. But any hate speech law should be very strict and only cover what is clearly considered to be hate speech under international law. That is when you are trying to promote hatred towards a particular race. That's an example of hate speech. And I think we need to have a law like that, especially with the comments we are seeing now.
It's interesting that you mentioned hate speech because from the way I see it at the moment, our communication ministry, their focus seems to be more on fake news rather than hate speech. So I barely hear any statement on, you know, of them assessing those statements that borders hate speech or just, you know, right on hate speech. So, yes, I agree with Suren. The last time, a couple of years ago, there was a movement to come up with the National Harmony Bill. And so this was an attempt to also, look into coming up with a hate speech law. But there was a couple of issues, and I think there were some views that were divided on that act. Or rather proposed bill, and we have not seen it until today come to fruition.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, we've even seen former ministers, you know, adding into that sort of hate speech. You know, former Minister Rais Yatim, he equated the impact of the large number of Rohingya refugees in Malaysia with those, you know, brought in during the British era in the early 1900s. I mean, that is, to me, rather insightful, but I don't know. But no action seems to have been taken for you know, making those sorts of comments. And that's a bit worrying, I think. And it seems to be fueling others to, you know, to be brazen enough to say these horrible, hateful things as well. Because if, you know, people who are in power or people who are influential are allowed to say it and no action is taken, then, you know, who's going to stop anybody else for that matter, right?
Yeah, I mean, when we look at the vitriol and the, you know, xenophobic statements and the hate speech on social media, I'm reminded of Malik Imtiaz actually commented something, and then he said that if you look at those comments, it seems to be manufactured. There's even a sense that this could be a diversion to what is, or rather the government's handling of the COVID-19 pandemic could be a diversion of, you know, handling the uncertainty due to the economy. But whatever it is, it doesn't justify the xenophobia and the discrimination on them. But also to all of us out there, we should be careful when we read comments and posts on social media, because it may not be the reality. It may be amplified by certain parties with vested interests, and we should be careful with that, not to fall onto that hate bandwagon.
That's right. And, you know, just another thing that was happening a lot on social media in terms of discussion, you know, was how Malaysia was justified to push back those overloaded boats of Rohingya refugees. You know, we denied them entry to Malaysia, even though it was, you know, filled with starving Rohingya refugees, you know, but we prevented them from entering Malaysian waters. I mean, what are your thoughts on that? You know, do you think we broke any laws in that sense by not allowing these starving refugees to land in Malaysia?
Yeah, we did. And again, unfortunately, the only thing we tend to fall back on in these sort of situations is, oh, we have not signed the Refugee Convention, so there is no obligation for us to receive them. As I said earlier, the obligation of non-refoulement, which means the act of sending refugees or asylum seekers to any place where their life might be threatened, so it's not just sending them back, but to any place, is also included in three conventions which we have signed on children, women, and disabled persons. I think it was quite clear on that boat there were children and women.
Yeah.
So by refusing entry for that boat, you are sending them to a place where their life will be threatened. So there is a clear violation of our international law obligations and also our domestic obligations in the constitution, because they were within the jurisdiction of Malaysia.
Mm.
And those persons were entitled to certain key rights. And the only argument I think which the state came up with besides the Refugee Convention was that, look, we already need to care for our own people. We don't have enough money, the resources to now, you know, go through and check all these people on the boat and to check them for COVID. And to be fairly honest, look, I think Malaysia is fortunate in the sense that we have a strong system or chain of NGOs who are always ready to reach out and help. And in fact, the NGOs have been doing a lot throughout COVID. So I don't think it would have been an issue for the government to receive the people on the boat, have them checked and give them proper accommodation and food. And I'm very sure NGOs would have been happy to help out on this. So again, this whole excuse on economy, finance, resources, it's just not substantiated in my view.
Firdaus, anything you want to add to that?
So when we look at the, you know, treatment or how we should have actually responded to the boat people, one, it's not just, you know, we're not just seeing a U-turns on our government, we are seeing U-turns on our responses to the plight of the Rohingya community. So, you know, to me, that is, you know, that's something glaring. Yeah. And then number two, yes, what Suren said earlier, you know, our fear, our uncertainty, our concerns on our economy should not be used as a basis to justify, you know, any xenophobic attack, any discrimination. And in this case, it's even severe. It's more severe. It's a denial of their right to life, because when they were pushed back and reading from the statements made, there were a number of people on that boat who just couldn't survive. They lost their life. They had to be, you know, thrown off the boat. And you know, and I can't bear the thought that, you know, we all had a hand in those deaths. And that's very, you know, that's very sad to hear. We, you know, we talk about, you know, these are illegals. These are illegals. But we don't actually understand the larger picture. And even if you want to go back to the law of our country, as mentioned earlier at the beginning of this, you know, of this chat, even our federal constitution recognizes that they do have a right to life. So even without talking humanitarian law, even without, you know, talking the human rights under the international law, we are not even following our own law, which recognizes their right to life, which recognizes that they too should be afforded protection under the law. But when we talk about the international human rights law, you know, we should be mindful that, you know, we too are members of the international community, and therefore we too have a certain obligation, not just for Malaysians, but to people who are non-Malaysians.
So, you know, just thinking of moving forward, for example, you know, as I mentioned earlier, we have about 4 million undocumented migrant workers and refugees. You know, how can we work towards finding a sustainable solution for them in the community, you know, especially when they fall between the cracks of the system?
Okay, I can start. There was an article, I think this was last week, by Tenaga Nita, Joseph Paul. I'm not sure whether you've come across that article, where he said that we should look into, or rather, we should actually come up with an action plan of how to address undocumented as an issue, not exactly the migrant workers, but why were they undocumented in the first place? So exploitation, what you call that? You go to the bottom of it and go to the people or the perpetrators who are responsible for it, not actually persecuting the victims of that exploitation, which is what is happening right now. So that's, you know, one example. They are also, for example, if they are here because they overstayed and their work permits are not renewed, is it on them or is it on the employer? And shouldn't we make sure that the employer renew the work permits? So, you know, that is one situation. So to me, that is what we should be looking at. And even, you know, much, much earlier, before all this crops up, whenever people talk about social ills, you know, doesn't matter, robberies or and whatnot, the first people who will be faulted for this is always the migrant workers. Mm-hmm. But we don't appreciate that you blame them for, you know, robberies or snatch theft or whatever, but you don't allow them to work in the country. So that's one. And then you blame them for, you know, their children roaming around begging and whatnot, but you deny their children the right to get education. You at the same time, you hear stories that all those schools which were set up by volunteers, sometimes they are raided by the authorities. So that as well. And as we talked about earlier, you deny them the right to access healthcare because, you know, they are then being reported for not having the right documentation. So to me, address those issues you know, and then you can address those other issues that's relevant to it. At the moment, even that also, we don't want to look at it.
Yeah. Sirin, anything you wanted to add to that?
Yeah, just two things very briefly from what Firdaus has said. The first is, I think obviously, like Juliet, you said early on in the show, there has to be some sort of systematic approach. And I think there's a fear on part of the government to sign the Refugee Convention for economic concerns. Mm. While those might be valid to some extent, but I think we need to look at a larger picture. So if the Refugee Convention is ratified, then that requires the state to have some sort of control factor in terms of who comes in, a screening process, and only if they're screened to be refugees, then certain rights must be given. Now, this is important because then you'll be able to better manage and control refugees and asylum seekers and give them rights that they're entitled to. The economic fears, to me, is not founded. Canada is a good example. They have signed the convention. They have received quite a large number of refugees, and they're doing very well. The refugees have helped the economy in many ways, and they can do the same here because ultimately there's a lot of sectors of work where Malaysians don't want to work in. So that's where refugees and asylum seekers can come in. Now, having said that, there are always scenarios where you get a mass influx, and this has happened in Europe, where the country might not be able to take it. That is a concern, a real concern. But the international community has a tight circle where you have this burden-sharing concept. So signatories to the convention are allowed to ask other states which might not have received many refugees for financial help or even perhaps send refugees to a safe place there. So there is a burden sharing concept which you can tap into as well. So that's one aspect that we need to look into. The second is going back to this xenophobic thing that's happening right now. This has to be addressed, and I think the best way to do it is to raise awareness. Because I notice, besides people who are doing it for political reasons, a lot other people hanging on to them are doing it because of ignorance. Mm-hmm. They presume that refugees are here out of their choice. They presume that they're illegal or undocumented because of their own fault. A lot of this is nothing to do with their fault. It is put upon them beyond their choice. So I think we need to raise awareness of the plight faced by refugees amongst the public. And for me, that is important because at the end of the day, the government, like any other government, will more likely act if it is pushed to do so by the public. So public opinion, although not the determining factor, is nevertheless a strong factor to push the government to act.
Okay. All right. I'm afraid we're running out of time, but is there any last message that you'd like to leave us with, or you think we're good?
I'm good.
There was a campaign not too long ago, I think a couple of weeks back, hashtag Migrant Juga Manusia.
That's right, yeah.
I think that's, you know, that's a good campaign. And then if, you know, if anyone is interested to know more, just, you know, look up the hashtag, and then you will see the arguments and why when you talk about migrants, when you look at the mass arrest, you know, there is something that's inherently wrong with that. It's not just because, you know, these people can contribute to the economy too. It's not just because these people, should also be treated if we want to ensure our health. It's more than that. It's simply because when you talk about international human rights law, when you talk about the idea of human rights itself, just because they don't have the right documentation, it doesn't make them less entitled to those human rights.
That's right. And, you know,
thank you.
And, you know, COVID-19 pandemic, you know, that does not create a justification for risking the lives of, you know, thousands of refugees and, you know, putting them in the face of danger.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you so much for joining me today. I've been speaking to Firdaus Husni, the Chief Human Rights Strategist at the Malaysian Centre for Constitutionalism and Human Rights, and Surendra Ananth, a constitutional lawyer. And we were discussing the rights of undocumented migrants in the time of COVID-19. If you miss any part of this interview or any previous Live and Learn interviews, you can search for the podcast on our BFM app, available on Google Play, the App Store, and also on Spotify. This has been Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.